Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Please turn to your verses for memorizing. And today's vocabulary word is in the third verse, which happens to be the verse we're studying this morning. And that word is vipada, calamities. Okay, so vipada, if you remember disasters, calamities, that will help you memorize this verse. This is the disaster verse. Okay. So, text 1-6. Savai pum samparo dharmo yato bhaktir idhoksaje vaitiki apratihata yayatma suprasidati. The supreme occupation dharma for all humanity is that by which men can attain to loving devotional service unto the transcendent Lord. Such devotional service must be unmotivated and uninterrupted to completely satisfy the self. 1-7. Vasudeve Bhagavati Bhakti Yoga Priyojita Janayat Yashuvairagyam Jnanam Chayadahoitakam. By rendering devotional service unto the personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, one immediately acquires causeless knowledge and detachment from the world. 1-8-25. Vipada shantita jasva tatra tatra jagadguru bhavata darshanam yatsyad apunar bhavadarsh. I wish that all those calamities would happen again and again so that we could see you again and again. For seeing you means that we will no longer see repeated births and deaths. 2-1-11. Yajam hidvidyamananam ichitam akuto bhayam yoginam ripanir nitam harinam anukirtanam. O King, constant chanting of the holy name of the Lord after the ways of the great authorities is the doubtless and fearless way of success for all, including those who are free from all material desires, who are desirous of all material enjoyment, and also those who are self-satisfied by dint of transcendental knowledge. Well, please turn to the beginning of the first page of your book with the class schedule. I'd like to point out a couple things before we proceed. First of all, does everybody have a notebook, including our guests? The yellow and green page. Yellow and green page. Yeah. So, in the fourth column from the right, the what's called section, just want to remind everyone how this works. We're going on Narayani Prabhu's book, Bhagavatam at a Glance, in which he divides each canto into sections. So we've finished the first section, Narada and Vyas. Now we're entering the second section, which is on the topic of Krishna going to Dwarka. So in between there are a number of chapters sometimes, and a number of different pastimes covered. So some mornings we'll have to explain a lot about what has happened. Other mornings we won't have to explain so much, and the speaker has the choice of using this book or using Narayani's book or just speaking from off the top of their head or from their memory, I should say. All right, so this morning happens to be one of those mornings where we have two pastimes to cover in the interim between our events from yesterday and today's verse. So two major events before we even get to the prayers of Queen Kunti. This is what it will take to finish the entire Bhagavatam in this period of time. So we go to some pastimes in some detail, and we kind of summarize others. But that way we'll cover them all. So any questions on the procedures? All right, then. If you would, then please turn to page 16 in the pastimes of the Supreme Person. Okay. I'm sorry, make that page 15. Yes, page 15, text 23. Yesterday we read, if you recall, about how the Srimad Bhagavatam can revolutionize the lives of the misdirected civilization. So that is equivalent with verse 22 in this chapter. So we'll start with 23. These are the beautiful instructions of Narada Muni to Srila Vyasa on the subject of Srimad Bhagavatam. And then Narada goes on to describe his own life, which we'll read about this morning. And then the plot of the Bhagavatam really begins in earnest with the story of Ashwatthama. Philosophy devoid of Krishna, text 23, philosophy devoid of Krishna has no valid use. And what to speak of troublesome material pursuits? Since you are wise, secure in vow, and held in high esteem, just write about Lord Krishna, and your work will be redeemed. For as the wind can rock a boat with anchor unsecured, those words devoid of Krishna cause the mind to be disturbed. Your readers cite religion as they sin their lives away, and you have inadvertently encouraged them this way. Who else but learned experts who've renounced all worldly vice could ever understand the deeper truth of human life? You surely have such gifts, Vyas, and I find you most fit to narrate Krishna's pastimes for your readers' benefit. A soul pursuing Krishna may attempt to serve, but fail. Yet such a person still exceeds the worldly who prevail. Lord Krishna will protect the deathless soul of one who tries, while one who worships money loses everything and dies. So learned, thoughtful people, philosophically inclined, do not pursue material success of any kind. Enjoyment of the senses can be found both near and far, and comes to us as troubles do, unwanted as they are. A soul who hears and learns of Krishna never undergoes another birth in ignorance, and this is why it's so. If only once one relishes the touch of Krishna's feet, he never can forget it or find anything more sweet. Lord Krishna is in everything, yet he remains aloof and relishes his pastimes, which are pure and absolute. Good soul, you're meant to help the world. Your time has come. Now please write more about the Lord and his sublime activities. For learned circles long ago concluded without doubt that souls imprisoned in this world and wanting to get out through sacrifice, austerity, or prayers that start with Om should rather hear of Krishna, who is praised in chosen poems. To give you an example, I'll describe my former life. My poor and honest mother was, in fact, nobody's wife. What does that mean? Yes, she was a maidservant. One summer, she and I were hosts to several learned priests who lived with us in study till the monsoon rains decreased. The priests were kind and merciful, and I was well behaved. Quite often I would listen as those great Vedantists gave enlightened explanations of Lord Krishna's famous deeds. I gained a taste to hear and felt my ignorance recede. To hear from those beloved sages purified my soul. I mimicked them and kept my senses calm and well controlled. The day the sages left, they smiled at me with eyes agleam and taught me confidentially that Krishna is supreme. Vyasa inquired, "How did you spend your life after that day? Your body is now deathless. Did that body pass away? As time annihilates all things a person knows, does or knows, how is it you recall so well details from long ago?" Said Narada, "The sages went away, but I remained, entangled with my mother by affection's heavy chains. She struggled on and managed to send me to school somehow, until a serpent killed her as she went to milk a cow. Lord Krishna can show mercy in a way we don't expect. Left homeless and an orphan, I turned north and simply trekked through cities, towns and villages, and gardens, farms and glens. At last I reached a mountain forest, shunned by other men. I felt quite tired and found a lake where I could drink and bathe. Refreshed, I saw a banyan tree and sat beneath its shade. Remembering the sages in that desolate location, I kindled my intelligence and practiced meditation. I fixed the thought of Krishna's lotus feet within my mind till love for him infused me and my eyes were teary blind. And then, within my heart, I saw the Lord as I see you. But in that blissful moment, I abruptly lost my view. Arising as one does when something valuable is missed, again I tried to see the Lord with childish eagerness. But failing to recover him, I sat and cried in grief. Observing me, the unseen Lord said this to my relief. Dear Narada, within this life you've seen the last of me. The vision you've been granted is reserved for people free of any worldly hankering, but still you shall be graced, for you'll forget mundane desire. You've had a higher taste. My child, when you serve me, I shall reciprocate in kind by bringing you to my abode when you leave yours behind. Become a pure, devoted soul. Be firm and never sway. The universe may come and go, but pure devotion stays. The gracious Lord withdrew his voice, and gratefully I bowed. I left that place in bliss, repeating Krishna's names aloud. Discarding all formalities and brimming with goodwill, I humbly traveled through the world, serene and quite fulfilled. I stayed absorbed in Krishna thought. My heart grew pure and free. And then, as lightning and its flash take place concurrently, I lost that mortal body, an affliction I don't miss, and entered my eternal form, enlightened in pure bliss. And since the dawn of this creation, by Lord Krishna's grace, I freely travel everywhere through heaven, earth, and space. While chanting Krishna's holy names, my tuneful veena hums, and through the sacred sound within my heart, Lord Krishna comes. Attachment left me helpless in a troubled worldly ocean until I found the solid boat of chanting and devotion. While grueling yoga practice keeps attachment somewhat checked, to hear of Krishna's pastimes thrills the soul in all respects. O sinless Vyas, I now have answered all that you have asked, so take it for your benefit and ponder your next task. Please write about Lord Krishna's deeds, which you can well express, and give your readers freedom from material distress. So here we see how Vyas asks a very pertinent question, what could be seen even as a challenging question. He asks his spiritual master, you're telling me you remember a former life, but how is that possible when generally everyone forgets at the moment of birth, the trauma of birth? Does this remind anyone of a question from the Bhagavad Gita? Nandakumar Prabhu? Yes, Arjuna asks Krishna, almost in a challenging way, how is it you're saying you taught the sun god the same yoga that you're teaching me, but he is much, much older than you. How is that possible? And so Krishna replies, can you use the microphone? It's just there.
He says, both you and I have taken many, many births, but I remember all of them and you don't remember.
Yes. Yes, many births. So this is that's actually the first verse in the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna reveals his divinity. And here Narada is explaining how his former difficulty, the great trauma of losing his mother as a child of 5 or 6 years old and being homeless and an orphan, led him to Krishna consciousness. Any comments or questions before we go on? Shrikar. By the way, I'm just going to explain. Vaibhav Prabhu is recording the class off the PA system. Yes, he is in the Pujari room as our sound engineer. So if everyone just speaks into the microphone, everything will be nicely recorded.
Is Narada the son of Brahma? So how did he take the material body in the first place?
Narada was a devotee who took birth from his mother, became a devotee in the association of these Bhaktivedantas, these great sages, and became so pure that when he left his mortal body, he received an eternal spiritual body. So that body appears very early in the creation of each universe from Lord Brahma. Or rather, he appears in that body through the agency of Lord Brahma. So he's considered the son of Brahma and also the disciple of Brahma. Anything else? Garrison?
Narada Muni is his, like, eternal form, right?
Yes.
But so when, so even if he hadn't had his Krishna consciousness revived at that point with his mother right then, you know, even if they'd ignored the sages and gone and played soccer or something, like theoretically later on he would have became Narada Muni and it was like an eternal pastime anyways, right? Is that the right conception?
Well, the question, if I understand you correctly, you're asking how could he be the eternal devotee and yet there was a time when he was just the son of a maidservant. So if it's eternal, if he's eternally in that rasa, then it should be going backwards and forwards forever, because that's what eternity means, right? So that is a question that's born of our conception of time. Because we're conditioned by time, we don't see things on the eternal platform. Everything in our minds has a beginning and an end. See? So it's at what point do you start being eternal? It's kind of like, I guess this is a physics conundrum, right? Can eternity begin from one point, right? Can infinity begin from a point, right? So actually it can't. It's because it's infinity. So in the same way, eternity has no beginning and no end. So how is somebody eternally liberated? They come to the platform of being eternally liberated. So in the material conception, we're conditioned by time. But when we become liberated, we're no longer conditioned by time. So there really never was a time when we were not liberated. This is a little difficult for our minds to understand because time is such a heavy presence in our lives and our conception. And it is said in the spiritual world that time is conspicuous by its absence. So being freed from that conditioning is just a complete new experience of life, which is something we cannot really understand or experience quite at this stage. But philosophically, just understand that is a platform of liberation, eternality. Does anyone like to add to that? Maybe?
I want to ask a question.
Okay, we need to move quickly, so briefly.
What is the original birth of Narada Muni, the first birth?
The first verse?
Yeah, like we understand Brahmaji took birth from navel, like so how the Narada Muni appeared. What was his first?
How does Narada Muni appear? Anyone recall this from the second chapter?
He made all of the... All the godly beings.
There was a previous pastor.
Yeah,
Singing. This is described later in the Srimad Bhagavatam. He was singing the praises of the demigods instead of chanting.
Oh, that's right.
Hare Krishna.
Yeah, and in a really proud way, right?
Yes, very proud. So, where does that appear? One of the later cantos, 11th canto. Anyway, somewhere in the Bhagavatam, he's singing the praises of the demigods, and then he is cursed to take birth as the son of a sudra. So there's some previous pastime there. So that lends some. I see where you're going with your question now. So that's a bit more of the history of Narada, but we'll discuss that another time. This is the part that's given at this point. Okay, so we need to move on to the beginning of the denouement, the conclusion of the Mahabharata. The Mahabharata has the whole history of the Battle of Kurukshetra and a little bit about what happens afterwards. But here in the Srimad Bhagavatam, we find the conclusion of the Battle of Kurukshetra. And this is the next portion of the text because it introduces whom? It begins the introduction of whom? Pardon me? But Parikshit Maharaj. Yeah, we have to now hear the history of Parikshit Maharaj beginning right from the very beginning so that we can understand who's hearing the Bhagavatam. Okay? And this is where it begins. So chapter 3. While vibrating his veena, Narada then took his leave. Vyasa began to meditate, and soon the sage perceived how people serve their bodies and ignore their spirit souls, and try to lord it over what the Lord alone controls. The soul encased in matter suffers superficial gloom, but hearing Krishna's pastimes makes him instantly improve. Since people do not know this fact, the learned Vyas compiled the pastimes of Lord Krishna in his clear and simple style. If one will simply hear this book, the cause of all one's fears, the sense that soul and flesh are one, completely disappears. Just after he compiled this book, the Bhagavat by name, Vyas taught it to Shukadev, his son, who had attained to perfect knowledge of the soul with nothing overlooked. So why, you ask, would Shukadev explore this vast new book? The learned Shukadev thought God was formless as the breeze until he heard of Krishna from the kindly devotees. Yes, even liberated persons, free of all desire, still hanker after Krishna, whom they naturally admire. By the way, that verse is paraphrased. Anyone recognize the verse from which that one is paraphrased? Yes, Atmaramas Chumuneyo. This is the Atmarama verse, which was elaborated on by Lord Chaitanya. You now have learned about this book and something of its theme, so I'll describe Lord Krishna. Let us first set out the scene. We'll hear of Pandu's sons and of the kingdom they acquired, and learn about the heir who took the throne when they retired. The Mahabharata describes the Kurukshetra War. In victory, the sons of Pandu managed to restore their father's kingdom, stolen by Duryodhana and clan, who coerced righteous Drona to assist their evil plan. Now Duryodhana's spine was snapped. In mortal pain he lay, as Drona and his other warriors all had passed away. But Ashwatthama, son of Drona, loyal to the end, conceived a wicked plot to bring Duryodhana revenge. The Pandavas, victorious as evening brought some peace, sent off their five young warrior sons to spend the night at ease. Within the darkness of their quarters, Ashwatthama crept and grimly cut their heads off, even as their fathers slept. Then Ashwatthama rushed his prize to Duryodhana's side, so he could see the youthful skulls and touch them as he died. But Duryodhana cried aloud to feel the children's hair, for they were all his nephews and the family's only heirs. Poor Draupadi, the mother of the boys, could not contain her anguish upon learning that all five were cruelly slain. Her mighty husband Arjuna embraced his wife and said, "You soon shall bathe while standing on this Ashwatthama's head." Arjuna settled Draupadi, picked up his fearsome bow, and rode off with Lord Krishna to fulfill his solemn oath. Observing from a distance, Ashwatthama turned and fled, but seeing he was trapped, the rogue abruptly stopped and said, "What else but the Brahmastra can protect my body now? Should I release it with my mantras? I do not know how its nuclear explosion can be harnessed or withdrawn. I have no other choice, it seems. I must invoke this bomb." On seeing the Brahmastra's brilliance hurtling his way, the mystified Arjuna stopped his chariot and prayed, "Invincible Lord Krishna, O most powerful and wise, just what is this effulgent that is blistering my eyes?" "Watch out, it's the Brahmastra," called Lord Krishna in reply. "That scoundrel Ashwatthama threw it, fearing he would die. You must send your Brahmastra to offset what he has done. Now quickly send your own, Arjuna. Answer, Drona's son." Arjuna murmured mantras and touched water with his palm. While circling Lord Krishna, he cast off his deadly bomb. As his Brahmastra countered Ashwatthama's in midair, the two Brahmastras scorched the earth and heavens with their glare. Arjuna saw the galaxy about to catch a fire and withdrew both Brahmastras as Lord Krishna had desired. His angry eyes like copper suns arising in the east, Arjuna tied up Ashwatthama like a squirming beast. So here we find the first appearance of whom in Srimad Bhagavatam? Krishna. And is it reminiscent of any other appearance of Lord Krishna that you can think of? In any other book? Yeah, in the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna is with Arjuna on the chariot. First scene. We find Arjuna driving Krishna driving Arjuna. So it takes up, this is how the Bhagavatam takes up just where the Bhagavad Gita leaves off, you see. As Krishna turned a thoughtful glance to Arjuna, he said, What will you do with someone who cut off your children's heads? A righteous warrior never kills a person drunk or mad, or women, fools, or servants. What to speak of sleeping lads? This wretched Ashwatthama sinned in such a dreadful way, he'll only suffer later if you let him walk away. The fool displeased his master. He's the ashes of his clan, and Draupadi expects his head. Arjuna, kill this man. Arjuna could not bring himself to take the sinner's life. Instead, he brought the bound-up Ashwatthama to his wife. Confronting her son's murderer through teary, reddened eyes, the gentle Draupadi said this, to everyone's surprise. Please cut his ropes, Arjuna. He's your guru's only son. His father was your teacher. Just consider all he's done. Now Drona lives on in his son, his widow's only joy. Please spare her all the tears I shed before my lifeless boys. My wise and mighty husband, Drona's son must be released, for now that we are rulers, can we kill the sons of priests? If you kill him, the other priests will curse our realm to fall. Without strong kings, the thieves move in, and chaos rules all. Arjuna looked at Yudhisthira, his elder, king, and lord, who thoughtfully heard Draupadi and nodded in accord. He felt that everything she said was scriptural and fair, infused with mercy, glorious, and spoken without airs. Throughout the vicious war, the sons of Pandu all survived. Now Sahadev and Nakula, the youngest of the five, assented with Arjuna, Draupadi, and Yudhisthira. But Bhima shouted, "Kill the wretch! His sin was too severe!" While glancing at Arjuna, Krishna smiled a bit and said, "Now Bhima must be satisfied. He wants the sinner dead. Arjuna, you must also please your ruler and your wife, who want to see this fallen priest preserve his sinful life." On hearing these conflicting words, Arjuna took the hint and sliced off Ashwatthama's hair and sacred ornaments. Now Ashwatthama's strength was gone. He sat as in a daze. Arjuna cut his ropes and drove the wretched fool away. Such punishment just suited mighty Drona's only son, for he remained alive, and yet his powers were undone. The Pandavas and Draupadi now turned their thoughts instead to dealing with the rituals required for the dead. Yes. Everyone is giving, we need the mic. Everyone is giving scriptural injunctions and yet giving their emotions, just like Arjuna does at the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita. Yeah. Yes, and then Krishna is giving equivocal instructions.
Yeah, so.
So this is actually the ecumenical quality of the Shastras. They cover all points of view. See? Everyone, every point of view has its voice. It's like Nanda Maharaj in the Indra Yajna. Krishna gives voice to all this karma mimamsa philosophy and all these other philosophies. So they're all presented and all answered through the agency of these various personalities.
Make the final decision clear. Like, what did they do? Like, it doesn't make it clear. Like, it's just confusing. Like,
it doesn't make the final decision clear. We have to finish this morning's reading for it to become clear. It actually does become clear. Okay? And we'll get to that. So, text 27. The ladies led the mourners to the Ganges banks that day, where all of the survivors then lamented, bathed, and prayed. Old Dhritarashtra, Duryodhana's father, also came. Lord Krishna gathered everyone and spoke to ease their pain. We must remember nature's laws will always take control, destroying all our well-laid plans and laying heavy tolls. So don't lament the deathless soul. Your loved ones have replaced their old bodies with new ones in another happy place. Duryodhana sinned greatly when he stole his cousin's throne, and he has died along with those who made his cause their own. Queen Draupadi's assailants have all paid the final price. Now let us help King Yudhisthira with Vedic sacrifice. The kings and sages present offered Krishna heartfelt prayers. Lord Krishna thanked them graciously, but then, as he prepared to climb aboard his chariot, he heard a desperate cry from Uttara, the princess, who was running to his side. Her husband, Abhimanyu, was Arjuna's greatest son, a brilliant young commander who was loved by everyone. But in the Kurukshetra War, a gang of kings conspired to butcher him unfairly, and he gallantly expired. The fair young widow Uttara was terrified and called, "Lord Krishna, my protector, best of mystics, Lord of all, protect me, Lord, protect me. No one else can grant this boon. The child of my dead husband lies imperiled in my womb. I feel a new Brahmastra's heat descending upon me and targeting my embryo to end our dynasty. It comes from Ashwatthama, for he's furious and wild. Please, let it kill my body, Lord, but not abort my child." Lord Krishna quickly turned his gaze on all of Pandu's sons, but Uttara's dilemma left them mystified and stunned. Nakula, Bhima, Sahadeva, Arjuna, and Yudhisthira all quickly seized their weapons as they looked about in fear. Now, in the war preceding this astounding final act, Lord Krishna had renounced all weapons, even when attacked. But when this mortal peril to his devotee occurred, Lord Krishna drew his razor disc, prepared to break his word. Lord Krishna saw the sons of Pandu looking unprepared to counter the Brahmastra aimed precisely at their heir. So he who is the Supersoul and lives in everyone appeared within the womb alongside Abhimanyu's son. Although the fierce Brahmastra can't be checked in any way, Lord Krishna, by his very presence, stopped its deadly rays. Oh, do not be surprised, dear friends, for in his wondrous form Lord Krishna starts and stops us all, yet he is never born. Text, chapter 4. As Kunti, Pandu's widow, watched Lord Krishna's wondrous act, she worried he would leave them without ever coming back. Indeed, his splendid chariot stood ready to depart. Approaching her beloved Krishna, Kunti spoke her heart. Sorry, before we get to that, just briefly. So, who is the embryo within the womb of Uttara? Right, King Parikshit. So, this is how his life begins. The first thing he sees is Krishna standing next to him in the womb. So, thus, when he comes out of the womb, he's looking for Krishna. Right, and therefore his name is Parikshit, which means examiner. Where is Krishna? Are you Krishna? So he's seen Krishna in the womb. He's examining everybody. So this, just check the character of Ashwatthama also here briefly. See, they let him go with his life, and then as soon as he's away from them, he again tries to attack them. What a scoundrel, huh? So after this, Ashwatthama was cursed to live forever in the material world and shunned by everybody. So he has to go around. He's very unpopular. He never gets invited to parties. He just lives by himself in a very wretched existence as a result of this terrible behavior. Yes, Rice? Yes, that's a very good question. They've already cut off his hair as a punishment for killing the five boys, and supposedly he lost his powers, but he was able to retain the ability to throw the Brahmastra. So he still had that power because that was given to him in the form of a mantra by his father. So he used it again. It was the last thing he had, but he was so ungrateful that he used it, even on a baby. And this is such a huge sin to attack an unborn child. All right, so now we're going to this beautiful section on the prayers of Queen Kunti. Bart, you had a quick question? As far as possible, yeah. That would be very helpful when we get to the end of the class. Thank you. So, Queen Kunti now has watched all of this. Kunti is the mother of whom? The five Pandavas. So she's actually the grandmother of Abhimanyu, and the great-grandmother of, right, so she's seeing her family being attacked. She's lost her five grandsons. She just about lost her great-grandson, who's the last surviving heir. And now she's seeing that everything is resolved. The battle is finally over. Ashwatthama has been dealt with. And now Krishna is about to get on his chariot and leave. So she approaches him and begins reciting these prayers, which are among the most choice in the entire Bhagavatam. So one of them we're going to read here in a few minutes. But first we'll read a summary of the others. Oh, best among all persons, Krishna, my respects to you. Almighty time and nature never govern what you do. Lord Krishna, you reside within, without, and in between each atom in creation, and yet you are never seen. As one cannot distinguish expert actors in a play, mistaking them for characters they skillfully portray, a fool observes you, Krishna, but can never truly see, for you have cast a curtain over your divinity. Prabhupada said that only a handful of people knew that Krishna was God, even when he was on this planet. My Lord, you come to propagate the yoga of devotion to all the learned sages who have understood the notion that soul is not the body, which the common folk don't see. So how then can we simple women know you perfectly? I therefore simply bow to you as Vasudeva's son, the child of Mother Devaki, but raised in Vrindavan. As Nanda's lovely cowherd boy, Govinda, you arouse the pleasures of our senses and the pleasure of the cows. The lotus-like depression on your abdomen adorns the lovely lotus garland, Krishna, draped about your form. Your cooling lotus glances make the imagery complete, including all the lotus marks embellishing your feet. You rescued Mother Devaki, O master of the senses, when evil Kamsa jailed her and made numerous offenses. You similarly rescued all my sons, O Lord, and me, throughout a constant series of extreme calamities. Duryodhana once poisoned us, then burned our house as well. He banished us where cannibals and deadly tigers dwell. When he abused Queen Draupadi, my Lord, we weren't alone, and now you've stopped the dangerous weapons Ashwatthama's thrown. So many times you rescued us from imminent disaster. I therefore ask of you, O Lord, O Universal Master, may all of these disasters come again, for when they do, you also come before us, and our birth and death is our through. So that is today's verse. Monday we'll pick up, finish these prayers, and go into the next pastime of Bhishma. So, text 1825. Vipada shantutakshashvat tatra tatra jagad goro bhavato darshanam yatsyad apunar bhava darshanam. Vipada, calamities, shantu, let there be, taha, all, shashvat, again and again, tatra, there, tatra, and there, jagad goro, O Lord of the universe, bhavata, your darshanam, meeting, yat, that which, syat, is, apuna, not again, bhava darshanam, seeing repetition of birth and death. Translation, together. I wish that all those calamities would happen again and again, so that we could see you again and again, for seeing you means that we will no longer see repeated births and deaths. Who's got the mic? Please read the purport. Someone there, please. Garrison, why don't you read half of it and pass it on there.
Generally, the distressed, the needy, the intelligent, and the inquisitive, who perform some pious activities, worship or begin to worship the Lord. Others, who are... thriving on misdeeds only, regardless of status, cannot approach the Supreme due to being misled by the illusory energy. Therefore, for a pious person, if there is some calamity, there is no other alternative than to take shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord. Constantly remembering the lotus feet of the Lord means preparing for liberation from birth and death. Therefore, even though there are so-called calamities, they are welcome because they give us an opportunity to remember the Lord, which means liberation.
One who has taken shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord, which are accepted as the most suitable boat for crossing the ocean of nations, can achieve liberation as easily as one leaps over the holes made by the hoofs of a calf. Such persons are meant to reside in the abode of the Lord, and they have nothing to do with the place where there is danger at every step.
This material world is certified by the Lord in the Bhagavad Gita as a dangerous place full of calamities. Less intelligent persons prepare plans to adjust those calamities without knowing that the nature of this place is itself full of calamities. They have no information of the abode of the Lord, which is full of bliss and without a trace of calamity. The duty of the sane person, therefore, is to be undisturbed by worldly calamities, which are sure to happen in all circumstances. Suffering all sorts of unavoidable misfortunes, one should make progress in spiritual realization, because that is the mission of human life. The spirit soul is transcendental to all material calamities. Therefore, the so-called calamities are called faults. A man may see a tiger swallowing him in a dream, and he may cry for this calamity. Actually, there is no tiger and there is no suffering. It is simply a case of dreams. In the same way, all calamities of life are said to be dreams. If someone is lucky enough to get in contact with the Lord by devotional service, it is all gain. Contact with the Lord by any one of the 9 devotional services is always a forward step on the path of going back home, back to Godhead.
Think for a moment about the greatest disaster in your life. Nectar Devotion talks about different kinds of manifestations of karma. Was it a divorce in your family or a death of a loved one? Have you ever been in legal trouble? Do you have some kind of mental or physical ailment or maybe a birth defect? Have you suffered poverty in your life? These are all manifestations of karma. These and other countless ways to suffer. What is it, that great Russian novel, Anna something by Tolstoy begins, that every family is that's happy is happy in the same way, but every family that suffers has their own unique way of suffering. That's the opening sentence of that novel. So, what are the disasters that you've had in your life? If you would just scroll at one screen, yeah? No, the purport. Yeah. Down the purport, please. Yes. So generally, the distressed, the needy, the intelligent, and the inquisitive who have performed some pious activities worship or begin to worship the Lord. This is a verse from, can anybody quote this verse? Chaturvidha Bhajante Ma Jana Sukritina Arjuna. Arta Jigyasa Arta Arti Jnanicha Bharatarshiva. So there are 4 kinds of pious people who come to Krishna. And the first two are mentioned as those who are distressed or those who are in need of money. Then the curious and the wise are mentioned. So of them, Krishna says, the wise, those who come to me out of knowledge, are best because they are especially dear to me. But all of them are great souls. So, getting back to Ankusha's question, is there a reason for these calamities? You know, and even in this pastime, we see, yes, there is a reason because it can help us come to Krishna. So, Kunti is asking very specifically, I'd much rather see the troubles of life than to not see you. So, what about us? We're having the calamities. We're definitely seeing those. But are we seeing Krishna? If you knew that by an intense period of suffering, you would see Krishna at the end, would you take it? So, what if you have the suffering, but you haven't seen Krishna yet? Does that mean the process doesn't work? What's wrong? It hasn't ended yet. Yes, exactly. Yes. We have not yet learned our lesson. You know, in prison, everybody is professing their innocence. Right? Just about everyone says, I didn't do it. I was framed. You know, but we can recognize by their orange jumpsuits that, no, these are actually convicts, and most likely they did it. So, in the same way, anyone who is wearing a material body is guilty. You know, these are our stripes, our prison suit. The fact that we are here means that we haven't got it yet. And now we have another chance to get it. That this is really not our home, this is not where we belong. And we're never going to find a comfortable and enjoyable situation here. So that's the problem with material happiness. Right? Even the mode of goodness,
You know, it's easy to see how the mode of ignorance is bad for you. It's easy to see how the mode of passion is bad for you. But what about the mode of goodness? What's wrong with the mode of goodness? Anyone remember from the Gita? Yes, it conditions one to the concept of happiness, Krishna puts it. So it reinforces this notion that, yeah, if I just get it together, then I'll be happy in this world. But that's just it's just an illusion. In the first verse of the Bhagavatam, Vyasadeva says this, that the material world, Krishna is such an expert mechanical engineer, that he creates this whole world to make it appear as if it's going to bring us happiness. And yet, it's just like that mirage in the desert. It dries up. So the animals go running off after the water, and it's never there, and you just find them as a heap of bones. So similarly, people without Krishna consciousness have not quite suffered enough, Hare Krishna, to come to that unshakable conclusion that this is not my home, I really don't belong here, I don't want any part of it. So we should understand these very bald facts about material life. It will never make us happy. And at the same time, if we just think that we will become happy by renouncing it, that's another nonsense. Okay? In other words, just to be detached from everything is another kind of renunciation that will not bring us to Krishna. That's called palgu vairagya, that dry renunciation. So there are those who say, you know, I will not touch money. I will not talk with a member of the opposite sex. I will just remove myself from society and go up and live a life of utter renunciation. Okay. But that renunciation cannot endure. And aruya krishtena param padam tata padantiro. Inevitably, they come back to the marketplace because they get lonely, Prabhupada said. So we should understand what Rupa Goswami calls yukta vairagya, the process of active renunciation, actually based on intelligence. That is the means by which we can deal with disasters. They have a saying in the material world, make lemonade out of a lemon. You know, if life gives you a lemon, turn it into a lemonade. Well, this is actually very good advice. They just don't know how to make lemonade quite as well as Krishna lunch. You know, we can take those disasters, and Prabhupada called them his nettles or his stripes. I forget the phrase he used. When Prabhupada was distributing back to Godhead, in Delhi, he was gored by a bull. Now, just think about how you might feel. Here you are, you're about, you know, almost 60 years old. You're giving your whole life for just publishing this magazine, just to glorify Krishna. And then you take the train to Delhi, this hellish city, and go around trying to distribute a few copies to people who don't want anything to do with you. And then in the course of this very selfless service for Krishna, a bull comes along and punctures you with the horn. So would it make you think maybe this isn't working? Maybe I'm on the wrong track? So Prabhupada talked, and there was no one to help him. Practically, he just had to drag himself to some safety. So he called this incident, he called this one of his medals, one of his badges of honor, that he had been through this difficulty, tested so severely by Krishna, persevered nonetheless, and was successful. So Krishna tests us. It doesn't mean that he has forgotten us. You know, he knows surgically how to remove any concept that we want to find happiness or expect to find happiness in this world without it. We can find happiness with him. See? That's yukta vairagya. We can use this world for his service, like anything. You know, anything except the four regular principles, basically. We can do it for Krishna, just, you know, if we're doing it as a sincere offering. Some of the devotees of Lord Chaitanya would come to him and saying, this Lord Nityananda is dressed up in silks and jewels and he's supposed to be a renunciate. What's going on? And Lord Chaitanya admonished them that No, whatever Lord Nityananda does is perfect. There's a bhajan. Even if I see Lord Nityananda going in a bar, I know he's going in there for preaching. So the disasters of this world, the disasters of our lives, can bring us to Krishna, and then they are great triumphs. That is that's the conclusion of the story. Without Krishna, disasters are just disasters. You know, and even if they make one more determined, like you sometimes read, well, this person had so many obstacles, but they persevered and they became a great scholar, or a great businessman, or whatever, stories of inspiration, right? That's just another disaster. It's even a bigger disaster. You think, now I've got it made, I persevered, I'm such a big man, I'm so wealthy, I'm well known. You know, that's a bigger disaster. So, sometimes devotees get showered with Lakshmi and fame. And sometimes devotees are just left in abject poverty. You just never know what Krishna is going to do, because every one of us has a certain set of attachments that he needs to remove by surgical procedure. So when you can be sure of this one thing, though, whatever happens to you, if your purpose is serving Krishna, it is coming directly from Krishna. There is no accident. If we can just persevere through the disasters, then we'll come to that realization very, very deeply. And the pains and the embarrassments and humiliations and failures of our lives become great impetuses to remember Krishna in all circumstances. So, just one more story about perseverance, then we'll end. There was a miner in Colorado during this gold rush in the 1800s. This man lived in the East Coast. He sold everything he owned, took all his money, moved his family to Colorado with great hardship, invested in this mine. He was sure there was gold there. They dug and dug and dug, and then he ran out of money. And he borrowed money from all his relatives and everyone he could borrow from, poured it into the mine. They dug and dug and dug and dug, and finally he had to give up because he ran out of money, couldn't go another inch. And he sold the mine for pennies on the dollar and was in huge debt. So the next owner came in, dug 2 feet, and found the richest gold strike in the history of Colorado. So, this is a true story. So sometimes we just seem like we can't go on another inch. That's when it gets really good. Any comments or questions? Okay, use the mic, please. Can we have one volunteer to pass the mic around somebody? Thank you. Maybe you just stand in the center and you might find it if you would. So.
That's when we should, when we cannot go another inch, that's when we should persevere and we will get our goal or like.
Yes, that's when we'll get Krishna. Krishna, in other words, is not interested in what we give, he's interested in what we're keeping in our wallet. What we have not yet given. Next, please, pass the mic around to Krishna.
Oh. I just wanted to know the 9 different kinds of services that they said they were. They didn't mention it, so I wanted to know them.
Okay. Shravanam, Kirtanam. Let's see, did we name them all? Vishnu Smaranam. Padasevanam. Archanam. Dasyam, Sakyam, Atmanivedanam. So, hearing about Krishna, chanting, remembering, offering service, offering prayers, worshipping the deity, padasevanam, carrying out orders, and surrendering everything. You get anything? Oh, becoming the friend. Yeah, befriending the Lord. So these are the 9 processes of bhakti. Yes?
The phrase that says that happiness is a choice. So how true is that?
Very good question. Happiness is a choice. Yes, everything is a choice. Everything in our life is a choice. And everything that we have right now is a result of our past choices. So that's our freedom. Our free will is to make choices. And yes, it is a fact. We can choose to be happy or we can choose to be miserable. We have that complete freedom. Sometimes it appears that the circumstances, the calamities of our lives are making us miserable and we have no choice in the matter. But if we understand this verse, that calamities are a great boon and an impetus to remember Krishna, then even the most miserable situation can be an opportunity to advance spiritually, and we can be happy. So this is actual transcendence. We were talking briefly yesterday about devotional service in the modes of nature. This is an interesting discussion from the third canto. Devotional service in ignorance means this one kind of service is the only kind of service that pleases Krishna. Devotional service in passion means I am the best devotee in the temple, maybe in the world. And devotional service in the mode of goodness means I am doing everything so perfectly. Krishna must really be pleased with me because I'm on time and I'm clean and I kurta is pressed. This is the mode of goodness. So all of these are subordinate to this one overriding principle. What does Krishna want? That is transcendence. And so obviously the material situation, if my goal is pleasing Krishna, then whatever situation I'm in, I accept that Krishna has put me in this situation to serve him. So even if it may appear negative in every single respect, he's put me in the situation to serve him. It's not happened accidentally. And then I can be happy. Knowing that, if I actually know that in my gut with conviction, this is not an accident. Krishna's put me here, then I can be peaceful. Yeah. That is a choice. So we can choose to see our lives and our circumstances as the fault of some stupid person, or we can choose to see it as Krishna's arrangement for us. That's our choice. Okay. Anything else?
So when calamities come and we find it really difficult to stay calm and so how should we know? You said we have to know Krishna. What does Krishna want in this situation? How do we know that?
How do we know what Krishna wants? There are three ways: Guru, Shastra, and Sadhu. First of all, we should use our own intelligence to the best of our ability. Try to understand what is our understanding of what Krishna wants by this circumstance of difficulty. Then we can consult the scripture to the best of our ability, find out references, maybe people who've been in other similar circumstances. Then, drawing our conclusions, we should test them with our spiritual masters and with the saintly persons. So that is our way of checking. If we are fortunate, the guru, shastra, and sadhu, they will all be very clear and consistent. You know, but we may also get multiple opinions. Sometimes Krishna is not going to make it clear what's the answer to that question. And the answer is only going to come later after we try something and it doesn't work or it does work. You see? Sometimes we need to have the experience personally to actually have conviction. Somebody may tell us their opinion, we may follow it, but then we may lack that conviction that comes from making our own decision, acting on it, and experiencing it ourselves. So Krishna has a wonderful way of making sure that we're never comfortable in this world. If you are a sincere devotee, then there will always be something just agitating you enough so that you cannot rest comfortably. Yes. Very sincere.
So it's said that modes are the responsible for all activities, you know. How do we understand modes? Are they energy or the personified some person, or how do you perceive them, just try to understand.
First, we need to understand that the modes are responsible for all activities if we have chosen to put ourselves under the control of the modes. Okay. So are the modes persons? Well, they are headed by persons, yes. They're called the guna avatars, the incarnations of Krishna in charge of the three modes, which are, who's in charge of passion? Brahma, yes. And goodness? And then ignorance. Correct. All right, so these modes influence everything, and they're constantly competing for supremacy. So all of us have them constantly in one combination or another. So how are we to understand how they influence us? Again, it's helpful if we use our own intelligence, try to understand the transcendental position, try to see how the modes are influencing our feelings one way or the other, and then consult with higher authorities. The pure devotees are also feeling the modes of nature, but they just act on the higher principle of pleasing Krishna. So that's always transcendental to the modes. Mam cha yo vyabhicharena bhakti yogena sevate. Bhakti yogena sevate. One who engages in bhakti yoga and service at once transcends the modes of material nature and comes to the spiritual platform. That's the meaning of advancement in Krishna consciousness. Nandakumarko, please ask.
What is more important principle? Having faith in higher authority, or that higher authority being actually qualified? One second.
What is more important, having the faith in the higher authority or having the authority being actually bona fide?
Actually, kind of close to that.
Question is that a devotee has faith in the higher authority, and the higher authority may not be sometimes qualified, may not be a pure devotee. So if he has full faith, will he get the full benefit of having a faith in a pure devotee? Mm-hmm. So which is a more important principle? Like we said, take dust of lotus feet of devotees. So is the devotee need to be pure devotee, or does the faith of taking dust is more important? It may be any devotee. So that kind of question.
Mm-hmm. One should not place one's faith easily. Okay? This is the admonition of the Shastra, that first of all, if you're going to place your faith in someone, you should be an educated consumer. You should know the qualifications of an actual saintly person. So again, to the best of our ability. So if we have understood who is actually advanced in Krishna consciousness to the best of our ability and placed our faith in that person, then we are protected by Krishna. Even if it turns out the person in whom we have placed our faith disappoints us in some way. You see? If we have just capriciously placed our faith in somebody because they're convenient and we're too lazy to evaluate, then it's not the same. Then we are, part of a cheating operation. You know, we've been cheated. We want something cheap and we don't care to discriminate, so we get cheated. And there's somebody very eager to cheat us, you know, ready and willing. You see? So, we don't have control over anybody else's devotion or level of advancement. All we have control over is our own power of discrimination. And that we need to exercise to advance in Krishna consciousness. So we can understand what is actually, who is actually advanced and who is worth offering respects to, taking dust from their feet, you see. And there are many worthy devotees. We are very blessed in this society. But, there are also those who may give the impression and are not actually qualified to help. They may act like it. See? So we have to know. We have to become educated. And that's an important part of our spiritual training. What are the qualities of a pure devotee? Ali Krishna.
But it seems to me like sometimes this idea of suffering is...
Could I interrupt your question just for a moment? Let us pray. Sarira vijaja the tendriya
jivangale sai sagare amajai jivayati lovamoy sudurmati adega kachina samsare krishna varadayam hoy kurivar jivajoy sapasadam dilovai Radha Krishna Gunaga, Vimei Rako Vashi Tanya Nita, Jani Vai Janita, Shri Prabhupada
Ki Jai. Haribo, please take prasadam.